If you can wade into the political arena and make it out unscathed, you must be doing something right.
Brian Burke is your host for Kitchener Today on City News 570.
Welcome to Kitchener Today. It is the final day of November. Because today I'm speaking that way. No, I'm not. Coming up a little bit later on this afternoon, the always quiet Doris Grinspun of the Registered Nurses Association of Ontario will join us. She sent off an open letter to Ontario's Premier about the crisis in nursing human resources. And you know what he says? What would be a good start? Repeal Bill 124. The Canadian Centre to End Human Trafficking urges all of us to act now. I agree with him. I don't think we think about it along this Highway 401 corridor and how much human trafficking is actually underway. It's Giving Tuesday. Does it help? That's a fair question. Does it raise awareness? I think that's true. Does it help monetarily? Tanya Little, the Director of Partnerships at Food Banks Canada, will join us just after 2 o'clock. And our tech spotlight is wound up. The hamsters are muscled up. We are ready to turn her on at 2:30 as Alice Kinsella, the marketing manager at Communitech, joins us for a while. All that stuff to come, but first. I need to update you on this story, which I first mentioned last week, but still seems oddly to me to be flying underneath the radar. And I can't have that. And since I'm probably one of the few people in the world interested in it, I have to get it out there.
Old friends. Old friends. Sat on their park bench like bookends.
Told you last week of the passing of Francisca Susano in the Philippines. You weren't here, Brittany. Still not sure if she was the oldest person to ever live. Born on September the 11th, 1897.
Don't tell me that the new oldest person only held that title for 3 days.
Not yet.
Okay.
Still, a tentative grip on the title. So September 11th, 1897, which of course, Brittany, means she was how old? Do the math.
Older than me.
Yes, 124, she says. Said to be the last living person born in the 19th century, she had 14 children, one of whom is 101 years old.
Wow. Yeah. There's some genes floating around in that.
A little bit. In her free time, Francisca liked to sing and play the harmonica, which, by the way, you cannot do at the same time. Also, her secret to longevity, because whenever anybody really old dies, we have to find out what's the secret.
Is it coffee? Is it whiskey? Yeah. What is it?
Is it a steady diet of whiskey? Because I hope that's the case. No, sadly, a diet of fresh vegetables and fruits.
Oh.
Specifically,
that's like the worst.
I know. It's going to get worse. Specifically, produce her family grew themselves without using pesticides. She especially enjoyed sweet potato.
Well, all right.
Okra.
Why is anybody
eating an American
she
television host?
She watched Oprah every day, and that's her secret to longevity?
Okra.
Oh!
What is okra?
Okra's okay.
Like kale with more flavor. So,
right. Oh.
Like, it's like, go eat your lawn.
Well, I feel like anything is more flavorful than kale.
Hey, I have kale salad all the time. It's flavorful if you put some poppy seed dressing on that thing.
Oh, if you put the poppy seed dressing on it.
Right.
Thank you, Polly.
So
thank you.
Let's deconstruct that sentence. Poppy seed dressing is tasty. Kale, in and of itself, not tasty.
But it's good for you and it's filling.
Oh, of course. There it is. There's the selling point.
Polly, have you ever seen how much sugar's in poppy seed dressing?
Hey.
Don't do it, because I did it once because I love that dressing and it made me feel really sad.
I can't remember the one that I really like. It's a Asian something. It's really, really good.
Yeah.
Can't remember what it is.
A lot of tasty ones out there.
Pumpkin. She also liked pumpkin.
Ugh.
And eggplant.
All right.
As well as plain oatmeal.
Oh, no.
and something called laswa, which is a boiled vegetable soup, which I'm assuming has sweet potato, okra, pumpkin, and eggplant in it, and then you heat it up. She did not eat pork and consumed very small amounts of meat. She also abstained from alcohol.
Oh, all right.
No alcohol.
I'm out.
I'm not entirely sure if she lived for 124 years or it just seemed that long. This is lasting longer than I thought. If that's what I have to do to live for 124 years, I'm not doing it.
Mm-hmm. I'm with you on that
one. I don't have to eat things like that, and I'm not abstaining from alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
Rarely touch the stuff, of course.
No, if I didn't go to the LCBO or to, you know, Waterloo Brewing, they would go out of business. They need me.
Guess who else isn't living for 124 years?
So please just fall in love with me.
Oh, it's Tuesday. Well, we should have swapped this around. I forgot about that again. Hallmark Tuesday, where Brittany dances for reasons that are beyond me, and brings us the title of a Hallmark movie, at which time we try to guess what the plot is.
Mm-hmm. And I have two for you today,
Brian. That's good.
We're going to start with premiering Saturday, December 4th at 8 p.m.
Hang on, I want to write that down.
Yes.
There.
Set your PVRs, people. A Very Merry Bridesmaid.
Very Merry Bridesmaid. Okay, so question, is the Mary spent M-A-R-Y?
Good point.
No, M-E-R-R-Y.
Okay. So the right way, okay. So obviously, wedding-based, right?
Correct.
So this is a bridesmaid. Obviously, it's a bridesmaid in an old friend's wedding and probably going to some kind of a country location, right?
They don't give the location.
Oh, okay. But there she meets an old flame, fall in love.
No, what? I think she hooks up with one of the groomsmen.
Ooh, look at you.
That's what happens.
That's just like Britney's wedding.
Oh,
sorry.
What?
Oh, you didn't know about that?
Carry on with your plot,
no,
please.
Okay. Or, does she break? No, that would, Hallmark movie, she would never like move in on the groom. That'd be a good Hallmark movie.
I almost
spit out my water.
I know, I think that would be a really good plot, but I don't think that's happening in a Hallmark movie. I'm going to stick with my, she's going to this place and meets an old flame. They have to work together on something. I'm not entirely sure what. And the next thing you know, they're in love.
All right. Lee's 30th birthday is on Christmas Eve, but this milestone takes a backseat when her future sister-in-law claims Christmas Eve for her wedding and asks Lee to be one of the many bridesmaids. Her childhood crush, Drew, is back in town for the wedding.
Ah, old flame.
He is determined to make her birthday, to celebrate her birthday and put her on a new direction in life.
I think I'm very close. Right? Always the old flame. If it was any good as a flame, he'd still be burning. Wow.
All right.
Is Candace Cameron Bure in that one?
No.
Oh,
no,
okay.
No, no.
So that's
what
the
about
one.
The girl from the Wonder Years? She's also
in those. Oh, Danica McKellar. Right. Yeah, she's in those all the time.
No, and okay, and our next one, this one was actually brought forth by Polly.
He can't
guess which
right,
this
I
one
can,
is.
I can't because I saw the commercial for this while I was watching one of the Hallmark movies over the weekend.
Okay, so this one, I want you to know too, is actually a sequel to one that came out in 2014.
What?
Aren't they all sequels of each other? Just asking.
Yes, but this is apparently actually a sequel.
A real sequel.
Anyways. This one is called The Nine Kittens of Christmas.
Was the original called The Eight Kittens of Christmas?
No.
Is that the sequel?
The original was called The Nine Lives of Christmas.
The Nine Lives of Christmas. Now we have The Nine Kittens of Christmas, which...
Premiering Sunday, December 5th at 6 p.m.
That would be 81 lives. That's a lot. Well, each cat has nine lives.
Each cat,
9 times 9, 81.
Yep.
Okay, Nine Kittens of Christmas. Why do I want to think this has something to do with an animal shelter?
Not necessarily a shelter.
Are these kittens found? They are found.
They are found.
So someone's trying to rescue the kittens and find them forever homes. Another one of those terms I just despise. Forever homes. And all of this is happening, of course, around. So she has to rush to get them adopted by Christmas Eve or... No, I'm not going to say that. That'll get me in trouble. That's it. And then, of course, She meets, you know, tall, dark, swarthy man wearing a lumberjack jacket cutting wood. And he helps her find homes for the nine kittens.
I think she meets a fireman, right, a fireman? Brittany? Isn't there a fire
yeah.
station
at
all? Because he has to pull the cats out of the trees?
No.
Hoping for that cliche.
So this is actually a female and a male lead. Zachary is a captain at the fire station in Oregon. A box containing nine kittens is left on the doorstep of the fire station.
Okay, so far so good.
Thankfully, his veterinarian ex-girlfriend, Mara Lee, is back from Miami for the holidays.
Ex-girlfriend.
Oh, right there, old flame.
Now, they ended the movie in 2014 together. Now they're broken up. Anyways, together they need to find appropriate homes for all nine kittens. But along the way, their two very own cats bring them back together.
Oh, okay. So I guess that explains then, because in the commercial for this, the fireman is holding a cat going, somebody dropped off nine kittens, but it's a full-size cat that he's holding.
Oh, no.
So maybe it's one of his cats that brings them together.
So yes. Did you say to the end of the first one they were together?
Yes.
But since that time, they had broken up?
They had broken up.
And now they're together again?
Now these, they each have...
Is there no one else to choose from in Oregon? Like, is the dating pool that shallow?
I forgot to mention it was Bend, Oregon, so no, there's no one else. They're lucky they do have the last remaining Blockbuster.
That was easy, though.
Oh, that's how I know that town.
Yes,
the last ever Blockbuster.
Kind of
a
fascinating show, that one. So I was right, essentially.
Essentially, yeah.
I didn't nail the firefighter and stuff, but wait a minute. Probably shouldn't have said that. We should let people in on some of the things that happened to your wedding that I haven't quite made up yet.
Yeah, I was going to say nothing happened. Thank you very much for that one.
Amy Schneider has now won her ninth consecutive game on Jeopardy.
Wow.
You're probably surprised to find out that puts her very close to the top 10 in terms of number of games won in a row. I would have thought that number would be higher.
Mm-hmm.
But you only need to get 11 wins to get you into that top 10 list.
Oh, wow.
So perhaps Wednesday for her.
Yeah,
it seems
that nine of them have been this year. How many... like 10 plus winning streaks have we seen this year alone?
Well, we had the I think what's his name, Matt Amodio. He won like 38 games.
I don't want to think about him.
Right? And then, he's weird.
I don't like that guy.
And then Amy now has won nine straight. 11 gets you into the top 10 list. She's already in the top 10 when it comes to cash winnings. That was kind of surprising to me, too. She has won just over $342,000. Long way from the top two, of course, Jennings and Holshower, at about $2.4 million. However, she is averaging almost $40,000 a game, which is better than Jennings' average during his 74-game streak.
Wow.
She has essentially wiped the floor with everybody.
My goodness.
There were a couple of players on that who were very, very good, and she just pounded them. She's very good. She's very good at ancient history.
Mm-hmm.
Which you'd think since I lived it, I'd be good at it. I'm not. She seems to have a little bit of a weakness in the sporting area, although many people on Jeopardy do, so that's not a specific criticism of her.
Was she on the same time when there was that question about Ottawa and the skating rink and all that?
She did not get that.
Because I remember, I think I had looked, actually, because that's the part I had seen, and she was actually at like 35,000, and the other two were... Well, the other one, because the other contestant was gone, but the other one was at like $2,000.
Yeah, the one contestant against her one day had similar success to the old Turd Ferguson from Celebrity Jeopardy. Numbers so low they can't be registered by digits. It was a really bad day. She's now she is tweeting all the time, but she has to be very careful what she tweets.
Yeah, she can't reveal anything. Yeah.
Reveal a whole lot, but she does talk about some of the behind the scenes stuff. They don't get a fancy lunch. They shoot five episodes a day.
What do they get for lunch?
It's just kind of a box lunch, and they have to sit at tables by themselves because of protocols.
Well, what's the fun in that?
In between filmings, you know what they do? They go over to the studio next door.
Okay.
And watch Wheel of Fortune?
They shoot Wheel of Fortune.
Oh, wow.
So they're in the audience for Wheel of Fortune. They're on the break from Jeopardy. And she says the Wheel of Fortune wheel is much smaller than you think.
Really?
That doesn't serve. It's probably like one of those little casino
little
table games.
A roulette?
Right? Yeah. And it's CGI. It makes it look enormous. But she says it's much smaller than you think. But you know what? I like to watch the contestants so I can see if there's a weakness.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't have a lot of weaknesses. She really does not. She knows an awful lot of crap about an awful lot of crap, which is generally what gets you on Jeopardy. But she had to interview 3 times to get on.
How many times have you interviewed, Brian?
I've only interviewed the once.
You actually got an interview?
I did get an interview once, yeah, and didn't get through on that one.
So how does that work? Like, I don't know. Do they just someone talk to you and they quiz you? Or
yeah, they just chat back and forth, make sure you're not like a completely wet blanket.
Right, right, okay.
You don't want that kind of person on, right?
That's really reassuring.
Well, I'm talk. That's like, but it gives me hope because 3 times. She had to interview, and then she finally got on. So
there's still hope.
There is still hope. And actually, I've changed my opinion on Ken Jennings. He's actually turning out to be a pretty decent host.
Yeah, you know what? I don't mind him.
He at the beginning, I didn't like him too much because he referenced his game all the time. Now he's kind of gotten away from that.
Yeah.
So because you know what, Ken? I don't want to hear about you anymore. I'm tired of you.
You've had your time, Ken.
Yeah. Quit stealing all the spotlight, you multimillionaire. Just the anger getting the best of me. This is Kitchener Today on City News 570. Somebody has sent me an email saying, see, this is what I don't know, that okra is not really a leafy plant. It's just kind of a vegetable and it's bland. Well, I knew that much. So I'm still not eating okra. Look, you're looking around because you're a very busy woman, Brittany, on Facebook Marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
Good for you. Way to, you know, way to use
always
your time appropriately.
Always seeing what I can get a deal on.
Well, what can you get a deal on right now?
Well, for the low, low price of $150, you can buy some of the Bieber merch that is selling at your local Tim Hortons for only $30.
Really?
Yes. So there's people out there that are buying the toque and the fanny pack and the canvas bag and then reselling it for upwards of $150. There's even somebody right now selling the little cardboard Timbit
box
for $20.
Because it says
just an empty box.
Because it says Tim Biebs on it?
Yeah. Just an empty box.
Well, maybe there's some Bieber fans in the, you know, the southern U.S. where they don't have Tim Hortons and it's worth it to them.
Maybe.
How are they going to find them on Facebook Marketplace, Polly?
But if you're not near a Tim Hortons because you're in, you know, Idaho.
Phoenix, I don't think has any Tim Hortons.
Right, but it's all in your area.
I know, but there's things called shipping. I know people do that.
No, but like things appear on your Facebook Marketplace by your location.
Do they? Or is it by artificial intelligence?
Or can't you?
Listen, at the end of the day, somebody's trying to sell a
empty box
bag.
For $20.
Yeah, and an empty box.
Oh, God bless capitalism, right? And, you know, hey, if there's someone stupid enough to pay $20 for an empty box, I have a tremendous idea for you and who to contact.
Yeah, what do they say? There's a sucker born every minute?
Yep, that's what Mr. Barnum said. But I think Paulie's right. There's probably people out there who don't have access to the merch. Either way, that's another stupid word.
It is.
Merchandise.
Merch.
Swag. Yes. It's only swag if you get it for free, right? It's merchandise otherwise.
Well, I don't know. Well, I guess. I think, I don't know.
People buy stupid things online, though. And
people sell
stupid things online.
Oh, yeah. That is also true.
I've seen people sell piles of 2x4s that are not useful for building anything unless you're going to build a house for somebody 2 feet tall.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I've seen them sell that. You know, $20, pick up the load. And people do it.
All right, what's the most ridiculous thing that you've seen somebody buy or sell online?
I saw a couple of empty boxes of something and I can't remember what. Now, it could have been a joke. And I think it probably was. But yeah, I think it was one of those KD special meals when they put the special flavors in.
Oh, yeah.
Somebody put one of those up for like $25.
Yeah.
And I haven't really tried to sell anything ridiculous, but I think you've got something with the empty Biebs box.
I know.
Some would say he's a bit of an empty box himself. I wouldn't say that.
Well, I'm not.
Come on.
Now, are you just complaining because he's local?
No, Pauly actually likes Bieber.
Oh, I don't mind some of his newer stuff.
I didn't say I didn't like Bieber. I never, that word never passed my lip. I just said, bit of an empty box. You can take that whatever way you want. This is Kitchener Today on City News 570. Heard a lot over the last little while about the difficulties in the nursing industry. Boy, there was an awful lot of talk about how important they are. And then Bill 124 comes along, which doesn't exactly underline that. Doris Grinsmont is the CEO of the Registered Nurses Association of Ontario, joins us this afternoon. Good afternoon, Doris.
Good afternoon, Brian. Thanks for having us back.
It's good to have you here. Tell us more about your open letter to the Premier.
So let me start by the fact that the open letter is a letter rather than a phone call because I'm desperate and so are my colleagues. I have a good relationship with the Premier. I call him. He often calls back. I send him texts. He texts back. But on this issue of Bill 124, none of that has happened. And the tragedy, Brian, is that surgeries are being cancelled. As we speak, the public may not hear because, you know, it's not in the newspapers until they will start to talk. You should actually tell ask the public to let you know. Have their surgeries been cancelled? Are their surgeries continue to be postponed? And that's all because we don't have enough RNs for operating rooms, for surgical suites, for ICU, step-down units, even emergency departments in some small cities. ERs have closed sometimes in the weekend, which is tragic. And the situation will become even more tragic if the Premier does not decide to actually repeal that bill. It has become a flag. You know, it has become a flag for RNs of disrespect. The Premier, of course, did not create the full nursing shortage. It started before with Mike Harris and then consecutive governments that did tinker, you know, a little bit and not enough. And then it came the pandemic. The Premier did not create the pandemic either. But from time to time, as you know, we acted too little too late. So, you know, that burden nurses more and more. But the pandemic in itself is heavy, right? 22 months of heavy, 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 16 hours a day work many times and 7 days a week during the height of it because we don't have enough nurses. But the Premier did create Bill 124, and he created it before the pandemic. So, you know, I mean, we didn't say much or any at that time because it was before the pandemic, even though we believe that nurses have a right to have their union negotiate for them. We are not the union. But then it became obvious, and I called the Ontario Hospital Association last December already, that it will become a key issue why they will leave, and they are. They're leaving a whole lot of them left to Nova Scotia. Others are going to Saskatchewan. Others are going to Alberta. Droves are going to the U.S., and then others are working, you know how, with an app. That's the latest, an app. So same as you go with your, you know, iPhone or whatever, you have an app, and you answer when you want, and when you don't, you don't. And the hospitals are paying $80 up to $120 an hour because nurses are choosing to gain control over their life. I mean, if we cannot have decent working conditions, you know, if they cannot have workloads that will enable them good work, and then if they cannot negotiate their fees through the union, they're negotiating them alone. It will be a disaster. It's already a disaster. It will be even more. So basically, we were desperate. That's why we sent the letter.
It may be one thing, Doris, 3 years ago when this bill was passed to limit increases to 1% when inflation is running at 2%. But now we see inflation running at 4.5% or 5%.
Exactly.
It's a little different game, isn't it?
It's a cut of 4%. Yeah. But also it was a different situation altogether. Not that we ever supported it. But, you know, the union is the one that spoke about that. But now we, the professional association that deals with public policy, that deals with evidence-based practice, we cannot say to the public that they will get safe care anywhere in the system, certainly not in hospitals, unless the premier really starts to act on this. Number one, by repealing the bill, and then the rest, we are there with him and with everybody else to bring more nurses, to retain nurses. But with that bill, you cannot even tell them that. You cannot. You cannot, Brian, because they laugh at you. Rightfully so.
So what options do you have, Doris, as an association?
Well, you know, nurses are calling me daily. The pressure is, quite frankly, brutal from my own colleagues. And they're, you know, it's like you say in elections, vote with your feet. They're voting with their feet in terms of the situation at work. And it's not because employers want this situation. They have no control, employers, because they cannot, you know, override what the premier has decided. So the question that you are asking me is for the premier, what options, premier, do you have for Ontarians to not have their surgeries canceled, to not have their surgeries delayed, procedures delayed, home care delayed, because you're digging your heel on this bill when anyways you will need to repeal it? Why not to act now so we don't keep losing RNs from this province, registered nurses? Why?
It has been the case in the past, Doris, right, that compensation is collectively bargained, right?
Always through ONA, always. In fact, they are in court, I believe, with government over this. But you know, I mean, courts take a long time, and it shouldn't be the way. It shouldn't be the way, Brian. The way should be that the premier that says that nurses are heroes, that knows surgeries are being canceled, that knows home care is not there for the public in the volume that needs to be for post-surgery, that he will say, okay, you know what? I did it before the pandemic. Now it's time to truly let go of that bill, or at the very least exempt nurses from it, so that we can move on to repair and rebuild this profession, because there will be, Brian, there will be a point of no return. I had a meeting today with people from the ministry and from the nursing community, and I said there will be. Give it 3-4 months, there will be a point of no return. No return. People will be waiting 3 years for their surgeries and procedures.
And I wonder, Doris, you might know this, that is the nursing industry, like many other industries these days, looking at a large-scale number of people at the older age range who are ready to perhaps move on to something else? Maybe that's retirement or just walking away?
So there is, first of all, there is a global nursing shortage, global. The U.S. is in tatters. They are desperate, so they're doing anything they can to take our RNs, which are baccalaureate prepared for years. They take them ready to go. They offer them to move. They pay them the master's education, et cetera, et cetera. So that's one aspect. And you are 22 to 36, 38-year-old basically are going. You know, many of them don't have the roots yet here. They think I will go for a couple of years, and then they stay, right? So many are doing that. Then you have the ones that can retire because, number one, can afford, and they're getting to an age that, yeah, I can work 3, 4, 5 more years, but no, you know what? I had enough with 22 months, and that's what they tell you of this pandemic. So they're retiring early. And the good news is that there is also a surge in people that wish to become RNs, nurses. And so, but you cannot keep them. This is the problem. If you have this bill and the conditions at work of super heavy workloads because you cannot keep the people, right, then basically all we will be doing is preparing more and more people so they go then to the U.S. or to Saskatchewan or to Nova Scotia or to wherever. That's not the solution. So, yes, let's bring more people. But the key is retention. The best, as you know, in your industry too, the best recruitment is number one, retention. So that's why I keep telling to the premier, this Bill 124 is like the key to the door, right, to stop the bleed.
Doris, thanks for your time today.
Thank you so much, Brian.
Doris Grinspun is the Chief Executive Officer of the Registered Nurses Association of Ontario. Jason, go ahead.
Hi, Brian. I've mentioned before on the show about Bill 124 and how it's a slap in the face to the heroes, as the Premier likes to call them. I think, if anything, this should be a wake-up call for healthcare workers or any public servant workers who decide not to vote or who do vote for a government that affects their own personal life. And I know for a fact, I have coworkers who have voted for this government or a Tory government in the past, or even a Liberal government in the past, where they've stuck it to you. And people, you know, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over, right, and expecting different results. So if, for healthcare workers, if you voted for this government, you have to look at yourself in the mirror and say, did I do what was best for my family, myself, and my coworkers? And you really have no right to B and C about it if you voted for this government or if you didn't vote at all. We knew what was going to happen. Bill 124 will eventually be deemed unconstitutional, but we'll never get, as healthcare workers, we'll never get back those 3 years of wages. So people need to get engaged. People need to look at the whole picture of what the platforms are of and the history of these parties.
And then we got to kind of hope they tell you the truth.
Well, you know what?
I know that's unrealistic.
Stick it to you, right? They're all, it's the ones who stick it to you less. That's the ones who you want in there. But you know, there was no need for this bill whatsoever. And unions have been, you know, crying foul since the day they introduced that bill. And this government continues to slap these staff members in the face. I can tell you, in long-term care, every single day they are working short. Every single day, there's not a place in this province where they're not working short. And as your caller mentioned, it's about retention. It's about paying them to stay in those jobs. I know there are places where they'll train. They'll have eight people who are now coming on board. And I know for a fact this happened last week at a long-term care facility. None of them showed up to their orientation because they probably got a better job somewhere else in the hospital, which actually pays more than long-term care.
All right, thanks.
We got a real crisis, Brian.
Thanks, Jason. Appreciate the call. And good to hear from somebody in the business. Pat, go ahead.
Hey, Brian. As it relates to the pay piece, I'm a big believer that the market will kind of regulate itself. And so I do think that as, you know, technology come on board and nurses have the opportunity to go work for companies that are offering telehealth, the market will regulate itself as it relates to the pay piece. But just with respect to kind of the sympathies that were alluded to, staff shortages and things of that nature, I have very little sympathy for nurses and administrators from that respect, just because you've been firing people that are unvaccinated over the course of the last few months and causing more of the pain. And so as it relates to certain aspects of this, I don't have much sympathy.
Well, I have plenty of sympathy for the nurses, Pat. Maybe I might feel the same way about the administrators, but I don't think all of the nurses need to take a 1% pay haircut because of that. So that's, honestly, I get it. But again, those numbers aren't as significant as some of the others that have been going on out there. Matt, go ahead.
Hey, Brian. Yeah, your last caller just touched on it, but I agree with what you're saying, that the pay cut is, you know, that's a shame. But this woman, I wonder if she knows how to spell hypocrite, because a couple months ago I heard her on your radio station complaining about the Doug Ford government not mandating vaccinations for healthcare workers and long-term care workers when everyone said it would probably cause a shortage.
Well, Matt, yes, okay. So when we hear that, let's pick a number out of the air, 25 workers have been let go from a hospital, you know they're not all nurses, right?
I understand
that. Do you know who they are?
25 or one.
No, but do we know who they are? Blaming that shortage on that, it is a bit of it. There's no doubt.
Does it contribute, Brian?
It probably contributes a small amount, Matt.
Perfect. That's all I'm saying. Thank you, Brian.
So that would make everything else then fine. I know that argument's coming. I get it. Let's look at this in another way. Here's a provincial government who passes a bill which says you will not get above a 1% wage increase, even though this is supposed to be collectively bargained. I don't like that in any situation. I don't care whether it's nurses or whether it's police officers or firefighters or anybody else who's in the public service. As our other previous caller said, you know, the market determines it. And I know we always want to keep public sector wages under control, which makes perfect sense. But you aim at one particular group who, for the past 2 years, whether or not they have been vaccinated, but over the past 2 years, this is a group that certainly has stepped up and done their job, as many of us have. It seems unfair to limit that wage increase, especially when they are, you know, not necessarily in a position to be able to withdraw their services. Sometimes that causes a few complications, but it is a, and let's remember, we just had a report earlier this week that the Ford government's deficit situation not nearly as dire as it looked before. So perhaps this doesn't need to be in place. Just a thought. Star 570, 570-2545, 1-800-570-5715. This is Kitchener Today on City News 570.
570.
Circumstances change, of course, and that's kind of in some ways what has happened, because Bill 124 initially coming in 2019, well, we were in a little different environment then, weren't we? Let's think about inflation for a bit. We were still living in our 2% inflationary world, living in a wage increase to 1%, at least from the strategic side of the Registered Nurses Association might be, you know what, this isn't worth having a war over, because it's only 2% to 1%, even if you are losing ground a little bit, theoretically, to inflation. When inflation starts to run at 4%, as it is now, maybe even higher, some of the underlying things considerably higher, then it becomes a different discussion. But as Doris pointed out, this will go through the courts. It may well be declared unconstitutional, restricting the right to collectively bargain. But again, those things take time, and as one of our callers said, you're not going to collect anything retroactively. And, of course, you're limited in terms of collective bargaining and what you can do. In many sectors, of course, if the collective bargaining doesn't work, then people can go on strike. Away you go. Not so much the case for nurses and other members of the public service. When you think about firefighters and police officers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that pressure isn't there either. But there are a lot of different financial pressures out there for every government. It seems odd that you would just decide to take aim at nurses. And it is, in some ways, a relatively easy target. Governments have certainly done it before, restricting wage increases for teachers, restricting wage increases for nurses, other healthcare workers. It becomes a relatively easy target for those who are not impacted by someone saying, well, we're not going to talk about it. We're just going to do this instead. It's the easy way out in some ways. And then you wait for a couple of years and you save some money. And then inevitably, there will be some effort to recoup those losses. And maybe that will be successful. Maybe it won't. But I can certainly see. My middle daughter is a nurse. She does not work inside the hospital. She used to. But she has moved into a more administrative position these days and largely working from home. And she's not undergoing the same kind of pandemic pressures that a lot of nurses are. But even she says the job has become considerably more stressful over the past 22 months. Manny, go ahead.
I know I mentioned a long time ago when I was talking to you about people leaving the country in pretty high numbers. I wonder if Doris does like exit interviews with, or you know, like a question as to why people left in the first place. Because I mean, we don't always leave because of money. I mean, definitely that's an important one. But I, you know, from my experience, it's money isn't always the thing. And is it, are they leaving specifically of Bill 124? I mean, I find that hard to believe, but I understand why people don't like it. And I understand what she's saying, and that's what Ms. Greenspun has to do. It's her role.
Sure, it's her job.
But I, you know, like anecdotally, and I mean, it's strictly anecdotal. I had quite a few family members go back to, you know, the country of my heritage because I'm first generation Canadian, and it was because of mandates at work. It'd be interesting to know because I know they fired, they let people go because of it, but who preemptively left because of it? And are they just chalking it up to, you know, a greener pastures thing or more money or whatever the case may be?
Well, let's be honest, Manny. There's a labor shortage not only here, there's a labor shortage in the United States as well. So if you're getting a better offer from the U.S., you may just be leaving because it's a better offer or better weather or anything else you want. I don't know where you get the droves of people are leaving, but I certainly haven't seen that.
Oh, did I say droves?
Well, I put the droves in. You said significant numbers.
Okay. Well,
that's a drove.
Significant for me anecdotally. Like, I mean, I've never heard. My family began to come to this country for a better life, and they're going back to a place that's very uncertain because they're going to feel safer there. That's weird to me. But that's happening more than anybody, I think, wants to admit. Like, there's some real estate.
How do we know that's happening?
No, the numbers aren't shared. I'm just saying anecdotally, and I know other people know that as well. There's real estate agents in town that have been talking about people selling and leaving the country.
But Manny, Manny, if you bought your house 10 years ago for $200,000 and you sold your house yesterday for $800,000 and you decided to move, I don't know, to some place where housing is really cheap. Here's one, Costa Rica. You're taking advantage of an opportunity that was presented to you. It may have nothing at all to do with the pandemic.
Okay, that's fair. But then also, Doris said it was mostly problems between, she's at 26 to 38, or that age range, right?
You know, what she said was the people who were 26 to that age had less in the way of roots and were more willing to move to another place because it suited their lifestyle. So, and I can see that too, because people wait longer to have kids, et cetera, all that stuff.
Yeah, I don't know why they wait. I mean, that was the best thing I ever did. I waited too long, but besides the point. Okay, and look, if you don't think there's anything to it, there's a litany of reasons why people are leaving.
Sure.
But they are, and it's noticeable to me in my life because I have, I guess, more of a direct connection to people who are newer to the country. And you know what? And very specifically with them, it's because of how uncomfortable they've become living in the province. And that's just purely my anecdotal.
I'm glad, right, that you put it that way, Manny. But you know what? I'm certainly going to dig around and see if I can find out if there are, again, my word, droves
of
people.
There's probably one of the real estate agents that you've said a little thing for as an advertisement that wouldn't mind talking to you about it.
All right. Thanks, Manny. Appreciate it. Look, I wouldn't blame anybody if they've been hanging on to a house here for 20 years, all of a sudden took the opportunity to make the profit and move to Costa Rica. Sure. Why not? But it may have nothing to do with the pandemic and everything to do with an opportunity. This is Kitchener Today on City News 570.
You talk too much, you worry me to death. You talk too much, you even worry my pet. You just talk too much.
Not that long ago, we had the producer and host of a City News documentary on human trafficking on with us that aired near the end of November and was certainly an eye-opening piece of material. But apparently the eyes are not open enough in this country when it comes to human trafficking. Julie Drydick is the executive director of the Canadian Center to End Human Trafficking, and that organization is calling on more than just concern from people. Good afternoon, Julia.
Thank you so much for having me today, Brian.
I have to think about this in a way. Even the term human trafficking sounds almost Hollywoodish, doesn't it?
It does. It does. And I think the term makes people think that to be trafficked, you need to be smuggled across borders and forcibly confined, when really this is happening right under our noses in our communities across Canada.
So what is the reality of that, Julia? Because I know a lot of people will think, well, you know, we're bringing people in from other countries. What is the reality of it? What does it really look like?
So overwhelmingly, victims of human trafficking in Canada are Canadian women and girls. and they're not necessarily being kidnapped by strangers. In fact, the vast majority of traffickers are someone that the victim knows. So they usually position themselves as a boyfriend or love interest or friend. They'll love bomb them, shower them with attention, and then quickly start pulling that back to coerce, manipulate, and control them into the commercial sex market.
And those women and girls at that point are often left with very few choices, right?
Absolutely. So when someone is in the depths of exploitation, they often have no control. They have no control over who they see, when they sleep, what they eat, how many forced sexual activities they need to have in a day. And the traffickers are all profiting hugely from this by keeping all of the money as well.
You mentioned then moving into the commercial sex business. That is a very difficult business to put an end to. We've shown that over the years.
Absolutely. And while there is absolutely a difference between human trafficking and consensual sex work, we need to have our eyes open, knowing that that entire industry is rife with exploitation, be it from violence from Johns and buyers or by traffickers embedding themselves, profiting, and really forcing and controlling someone through the commercial sex industry.
I know the survey that is out. I guess what surprises me is that more than half of people who took that survey don't believe that human trafficking is actually happening right in their own area. I guess maybe we look at it as a Toronto, Vancouver, Montreal problem.
I think we look at it as a major urban city issue. I also think it's the politeness of Canadians. They just don't want to think that something so gross is happening in their communities. When really even research that we released last February shows that traffickers are systematically moving their victims from town to town, urban and rural, to capitalize off of those commercial sex markets while also keeping their victims isolated, controlled, and socially isolated from other people that might be able to help.
Is there an organizational aspect to this, Julia? I didn't want to use the term organized crime because that creates another image for people, but I guess that's the question. Is there an organized crime aspect to this?
There is and there can be. And for example, we recently saw a major bust in York Region in the GTA that involved a more kind of organized crime ring. But more often than not, this is happening independently. These are traffickers, they're pimps, and they're working independently for their own gain. So it's absolutely not always an organized criminal activity.
The independence of that makes it, I would assume, even more difficult to stop.
Absolutely. And our governments are doing a better job in terms of trying to track the money using FinTrack, which is a federal investigative body. But again, you're completely right. When people are working independently, it's harder to be able to kind of track, but then also gather the evidence to really hold these traffickers to account.
This business didn't suffer at all during the pandemic, did it?
No. Absolutely not. And in fact, call volume to the Canadian Human Trafficking Hotline has only increased since the pandemic. So I can definitively say that regardless of border closures or lockdowns, human trafficking is alive and well in communities across the country.
I know one of the suggestions that the center makes is to pay attention and to know the signs of human trafficking. But I think it's fair to say, Julia, that most of us think we don't live in that world.
Yep, I think that's fair. And I think it's scary. There's also so much stigma and there's so much fear associated with the commercial sex industry. I think our biggest call to action is if something doesn't feel right, it probably isn't. And traffickers game the lack of awareness across the country to be able to continue to propagate this gross form of exploitation. So our call to action, too, is also if something doesn't feel right, it probably isn't. Trust your judgment and call us at the Canadian Human Trafficking Hotline at 1-833-900-1010. We're independent of law enforcement and government. We're trauma-informed with over 60 hours of training per staff, and we're here to help.
So we really are, in some ways, Julia, asking people to look at perhaps one of their friends, one of their relatives' relationship and make a judgment on that. That goes against everything that we're supposed to do.
I'm not sure. And I think part of what we do as a service is we talk about how to keep those open lines of communication. if someone has a new partner and is all of a sudden kind of pulling away from their friends and family, if they're being secretive about what they're doing, if they're showing signs of being controlled, if they're having bruises, cuts, new tattoos, we can help talk to people about how to keep those lines of communication open, but also to do so in a safe way that provides resources and supports to potential victims to look at opportunities to exit when they realize that something right isn't happening.
So really the point that I wanted to get to here is that the hotline is as much a resource for people who are concerned about someone than it is for someone who is embroiled in the world of being trafficked.
Absolutely. And in fact, in our first year of operation, a significant proportion of human trafficking cases that we identified came from friends and family members. They are pivotal. They're so important in terms of awareness and detection, but often exiting and accessing supports can be incredibly complicated. And we've really seen friends and family step up to help their loved ones as they try to exit and get those crucial services that they need to be able to heal.
There are success stories, right? Because I think we need those.
Absolutely, absolutely. And while, you know, the trauma that a lot of survivors face can stay with them in some extent for the rest of their lives, survivors are resilient. They are powerful. And I think some of the stories that we've seen of people reclaiming their lives and also then giving back and becoming, you know, connected to being part of the solution is really inspiring.
I hate to boil things down all the time to supply and demand, but this is a supply and demand issue in some ways, isn't it? As long as this demand exists, it's difficult to stop. How do we deal with that?
You know, I don't know if anyone has really figured that out. I'm a researcher at heart. If you look at different jurisdictions, I don't think any community, city, province, state have ever really kind of figured that out. And it seems like a really simple solution. And there's a lot of advocates that say, yes, ending demand will end the issue. But I think before we get there, we need to look at the realities of exploitation today and hone in on that. We can't wait for a perfect future solution in order to, you know, deal with the realities of the exploitation that's happening in front of us every day. So, yes, the entire commercial sex industry can be rife with exploitation. But let's also focus right now on how that exploitation is taking place so that we can intervene and engage as communities to try and reduce the prevalence across the country.
In a way, it's kind of disrupting a supply chain, which could be impactful at the other end.
It could be, absolutely. And I think it's important for people to know, with eyes wide open, that, you know, there is exploitation taking place. There aren't, escort websites that are only for trafficking or only for independent sex workers. There aren't strip clubs that are only for trafficking victims and only for consensual sex workers. And so often it's interlaced, and traffickers know this, and they use the subtlety, and they often force their victims to present as if it's completely consensual, again, because it yields a higher return on demand and higher profit margins.
Is there legislation here, Julia, that would help?
You know, I think right now one of the most important things that we need to do is focus on education and awareness. Our research shows the amount of the lack of education among Canadians is shocking. And if we're not looking for the right things, we're never going to find it. So we need wide sweeping public education across the general public and in our schools. But we also need to look at making things like the criminal justice system less traumatizing and more accessible for survivors. Right now, traffickers are gaming a system where it's hard to be detected by law enforcement. There's a huge amount of money involved. And because of the lack of awareness, they're able to, again, emotionally and psychologically control a victim to make them think that they're doing it to themselves or that they're actually the guilty ones at play. So it's a complicated issue. We need to be taking a whole bunch of different tactics to be able to look at how to end the crime in Canada.
And are we making some of those changes, Julia, that you can see?
We're starting to see that. The government of Ontario has recently mandated that all school boards are required to develop a human trafficking curriculum, and that they report back on it. We are seeing strong investments across Ontario in the supports and services that are required to exit, things like emergency shelter, counseling, rehab supports, as well as case management and other kind of support services. So we're starting to see some traction in Ontario. The problem is that it's different across the country. So when people start, you know, locking down on human trafficking in one province, traffickers will just move. So we really need coordinated and collective efforts by all provinces, across law enforcement and communities, so that traffickers can't simply just pick up and leave and go to the next community where they're going to be able to profit without being detected.
When we talk about that education piece in the schools, Julia, like, what does that education piece look like? Because I'm not sure that we need education that says human trafficking is wrong. What are we trying to educate and whom?
I think we really need to be focusing on healthy relationships and the continuum of exploitation along gender-based violence. So often these trafficking situations start out looking like intimate partner relationships, right? It's an older boyfriend who is showering someone with love, attention, and gifts.
And everybody wants that, right?
And everybody wants that. But then soon they start taking that away. And then also saying that the individual owes them for maybe the gifts and the showers. Really, Canadians need to know, we need to teach our youth early that love shouldn't come with a cost. That really healthy relationships are about reciprocal healthy relationships. If something is too good to be true, it probably is. But also knowing their rights around consent, how to push back, how to leave unhealthy relationships as well. So if we get at the heart of that amongst our youth, maybe we'll have a little bit more resilience for them to be able to spot the signs and to be able to push back when someone tries to lure and groom them into sex trafficking in Canada.
Yeah, and maybe when, you know, they end up having that difficult conversation, which is, no, I'm not being forced into anything here. This is just the way we are, that they'll listen and take that step, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think part of it, too, is as adults and community members, you know, this stuff is really hard. And I think, you know, teenagers generally are hard. They're starting to do things that as grown-ups we don't necessarily want to hear about. But our kids need to know that they're loved unconditionally and that those doors are always open and that there's nothing they can do to ever jeopardize that love. And I think that's often a tool that's used against you and minors specifically, being told that no one will love them, that they'll be, you know, rejected if people find out what they've been doing.
And then that question that I'm sure that many of these victims have is, well, if I just do this, things will get better.
Exactly, exactly. And similarly to other forms of domestic violence, you know, there might be, you know, verbal or physical violence. And again, there's that desperation to go back to that honeymoon period where everything is fine. Traffickers are doing this intentionally. They're also doing it to make huge amounts of profit. But the trauma on the individual can be absolutely overwhelming.
Julia, how does the Canadian Centre to End Human Trafficking, how is it funded?
So we receive a large portion of our funding through the federal government, through Public Safety Canada, and then also through some private family foundations as well. So we're very grateful for their support. But we're also, you know, so appreciative from the support of general Canadians as well. So if people are interested in the issue, I know the holidays are coming up, they can find out more about our organization and they can donate at www.CanadianCentreToEndHumanTrafficking.ca.
And you have the hotline as well. You can give that number again.
The number for the hotline is 1-833-900-1010.
And there is also a website connected to that, right?
It is. It's www.CanadianHumanTraffickingHotline.ca.
Julia, thanks for your work on this.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And thanks for your ongoing coverage. It's such an important issue. And
Julia Drodek is the Executive Director of the Canadian Centre to End Human Trafficking. In their survey, it says, well, most of us don't think that it happens in our own backyard. Of course it does. And that there's a significant amount of belief that it looks a lot like what you might see in some movies. But the reality is that most of the victims of human trafficking in this country are from this country. They're not being smuggled in and then trafficked in that way. This is Kitchener Today on City News 570.
While there is absolutely a difference between human trafficking and consensual sex work, we need to have our eyes open, knowing that that entire industry is rife with exploitation, be it from violence from Johns and buyers or by traffickers embedding themselves, profiting, and really forcing and controlling someone through the commercial sex industry.
The healthy thing over the past couple of years has been the increased attention on the issue of human trafficking. It's been done even locally. Former Mayor Brenda Halloran has spoken extensively about that in the past. So it has brought more attention to the issue. However, it is still, I think, largely treated as something that happens maybe just in the movies. And yes, it's there's an education piece to this because enforcement, very difficult to deal with. Obviously, shadowy operations are much more difficult. So much of it is being done independently, so like a one-on-one situation as opposed to an organized crime situation, that makes it difficult as well. And of course, the victim's not willing to speak in many cases, and you can't necessarily cast anything over on that. So there are a lot of different parts to this particular package which still need an awful lot of work. But education at the end of the day, and it's not just education that says human trafficking is bad. It's education that says this is what an actual healthy relationship looks like, and let's work towards that. Coming up a little later on this afternoon, it is Giving Tuesday. And look, I have been involved in a Giving Tuesday at a nonprofit organization. I always had some questions about the day itself, especially with it being piggybacked on top of Black Friday, and then you had Cyber Monday, and then you had Giving Tuesday. And I wondered, and I still wonder, about the effectiveness of it in terms of actually raising money, which is kind of what it's designed to do. Whether or not it's all that effective is, it's a little bit out. Does it have some impact on raising awareness? Perhaps it will. On a single day, you might hear about a bunch of different charities. And I do know of cases, and this wasn't anecdotal, it was what I actually saw happen, where there were organizations that managed to find one of their regular donors who would say, look, I'll match any donations made on Giving Tuesday up to a total of, say, for example, $10,000. And there would be some matching donations. So was it all about raising money? Well, I think it started off that way. Then I think it became more about awareness. Is it effective? Well, I believe the jury is out on that. I'm sure there are some people who will tell me it's worked fabulously for them. But I knew at the time when I was dealing with the Giving Tuesday platform, you kind of go in your head, well, great idea, but holy cow, look at all the organizations that are looking for support in this day. In a 500-channel universe, I'm not sure you're getting all that much attention on that single day. It's an interesting discussion. We'll talk with Tanya Little, the Director of Partnerships at Food Banks Canada, just after 2 this afternoon. And our tech spotlight, Alex Kinsella, the marketing manager for Communitech, will join us, tell us about some of the things that are going on in the Communitech Hub over the upcoming holiday season. I say upcoming because it doesn't start for me until December the 1st. This is Kitchener Today on City News 570.
Well, the people all said, sit down, you're rocking the boat. People all said, sit down, you're rocking the boat. And the devil will drag you under by the sharp lapel of your checkered coat. Sit down, sit down, sit down, sit down, sit down, you're rocking the boat.
Just a reminder, as you listen to that newscast, and of course the latest traffic report, and then there were some accidents out there, and some things can be a little slippery. Remember, we do know how to drive in the winter, but you could slow down. Someone almost took out your favorite afternoon talk show host this morning as I walked the dog, and he screamed along a certain road at a speed that was far in excess of what would be considered safe. So let's not be taking out the favorite afternoon talk show host in the region. Just slow down. Way better to get there a couple minutes later than to slam into each other. So avoid doing that, and especially in about an hour and a half when I will be on the road, because sometimes, yes, it is all about me. So if you slow down, then you can protect me, and that's what you should be thinking about. What is the situation in detention centers in the province when it comes to young people and whatever education they might be receiving? Now, look, if you're already in a detention center, we know we are having some issues. And shouldn't we be doing the best we can to fix those issues, the best to our ability? we may not be. Brenda McPhail joins us this afternoon from the Canadian Civil Liberties Association. Good afternoon, Brenda.
Hello.
Your report on what is happening to Ontario youth in detention facilities, what age group are we talking about here, Brenda?
So we spoke with young people who are age 16 and above, and in part that was for ethical reasons, because at that age they're allowed to give us their consent to participate in an interview.
Now, you also spoke to staff and teachers, and who else did you speak with?
We talked to defense lawyers, we talked to staff in the facilities, we talked to some teachers outside the facilities, but weren't allowed to talk to any inside due to school board rules, and we talked to a range of students. So we talked to more than 50 people in total.
The detention facilities that we have in Ontario, where are they, Brenda? Just so we kind of get a sense of what we're dealing with.
So there are detention centers spread throughout the province. They're divided into regions, and there are centers east, west, north, and south in Ontario.
So it's a pretty good cross-section of Ontario youth, let's put it that way.
Yes, it is.
And so what are these, I want to call them kids, but what are these youth in detention for?
Well, there's a range of charges. To be honest, we weren't focused on why they were there. We know if they're there that they had an encounter with the criminal justice system. We also know that a lot of the young people who are in these facilities actually haven't yet been convicted of a crime. A number of the youth that we talked to were on something called remand, which is basically they didn't get bail, and so they were in there awaiting their trial. So we've got people who were convicted. We've got people who have yet to be convicted. And in general, it tends to be fairly serious charges because we do have a policy in Ontario of not wanting to incarcerate young people. So the people who are in there tend to be the ones who are the most marginalized, the most vulnerable, the ones who have had a really hard row to hoe over the course of their life and need some help.
And perhaps those most likely in need of some kind of educational help, right?
Absolutely. One of the things we found when we were talking to young people and looking at the barriers that they faced in education is that a lot of them weren't well served by the school system before they got into trouble, before they ended up engaged in the criminal justice system. And in an ideal world, at the point that they do become engaged in the system, that would be a place to fix some of those problems, to give them the individualized and careful attention they need to get them back on a good track, because we know that education is one of the most dominant factors to predict rehabilitation.
So in my mind, I have this vision, Brenda, that says, you know, these young people are in detention. They are facing, you know, some serious charges, but there is some structure there that provides them perhaps an opportunity to catch up on what they've missed, or perhaps an opportunity to learn better skills that will move them along. Is that what happens?
That's what's supposed to happen. Unfortunately, what we found is that there are really extreme differences in both the quality and the quantity of educational opportunities that detention facilities provide across the province. One of our biggest concerns was we were told by our participants that particularly where facility populations consist primarily or disproportionately of young people who are Black, those were the places where the culture was more likely to be oriented towards security, where the young people weren't looked at as, you know, potential students or learners. They were looked at as security threats. And those were the places where the educational opportunities tended to be the most limited, and where education was treated as sort of a privilege rather than a requirement. As it is for every other young person in Ontario, it's, you know, education is a requirement. In these places, small infractions in policies could result in them being denied access to even the limited amount of educational time they had.
You mentioned a couple of interesting words there, but there is a real balancing act here, right, between security and education?
Absolutely. And of course, it's the duty of these facilities to make sure that those young people who are inside are safe, and that the, you know, and the people who work with them are also safe. But what we were told and what we found is that the way that young people were treated made a huge difference in terms of how they behaved. And we know that with our own children. It's no different for these young people in these facilities. And so it really matters the culture really matters. And the access to education was something that was identified by the young people themselves as a chance to better themselves while they were incarcerated, as a chance to try and escape the cycle that they'd been in, as a chance to get their life back on track. And so some of them expressed, you know, really sincere disappointment with the fact that they, in some cases, were getting an hour of school a day, which is, you know, vastly different than what we afford to every other child in Ontario.
Do we know if this has gotten worse during the pandemic, Brenda?
So we did do our interviews during COVID. We talked to people about their experiences before and during. It certainly did get worse during COVID. And to be fair, that is the case for every student across Ontario.
Sure.
The education system really got turned upside down during this pandemic. But what we were told in the facilities is because they weren't getting as much in the first place, when it was cut back, it got much worse for them. And in many places, although schools outside of facilities are on the path to getting back to normal, that wasn't necessarily the case in the facilities where we spoke to people yet.
I know this, Brenda. There are a lot of people who would look at these youth and say, well, you know what? They did their crime. They can spend their time in there. I'm done with them. But then I have a prisoner advocate who speaks here on a regular basis who always reminds me that the people that we have in detention are eventually going to get out, and we should do everything we can to make them better when that happens.
That is absolutely right. The fact that these young people have lost their liberty, they're incarcerated, that's the punishment. That is the price that they have paid. An additional cost should not be deprivation of the education they need so that when they get out, they have a better chance of being a contributing member of society. And if we don't educate these young people well, that affects them, it affects their families, and it affects all of us as the general public, because, you know, the criminal justice system is something that impacts all of us ultimately, because it creates It creates a situation where we have either public safety or not.
I know the Canadian Civil Liberties Association has made some recommendations for governments to follow. What are the highlights of those recommendations for you?
So our study was a qualitative study. That meant we talked to people about their lived experience. We don't have statistics and figures, but we believe that they're needed. What we've seen are some disturbing trends that need to be documented. So one of our primary recommendations was that there should be immediately an audit commissioned of the educational programs in youth detention centers, and that should be public. We also think there should be minimum standards for both the quantity and quality of education for these vulnerable young people. And there needs to be accountability. So we need an independent, well-resourced oversight body for corrections. This is a recommendation that was made long ago by the Independent Advisor on Correctional Reform. We echo it. And lastly, we think that one of the things we found is that school boards actually don't have a legislated requirement to provide schooling for these young people in facilities. It's something that gets negotiated between the facility and a board. We don't think that that's right. We think that legislation should be amended to make sure that every student has the right to be educated by a school board, and that facilities don't have to sort of negotiate and walk on brass tacks with boards in order to get them to come in and provide these young people with some schooling.
Yeah, that's surprising that the boards wouldn't have more of a role.
Yes, and one of the things we talk about at some length in the report is the impact that has, because there have been cases where a board decides they will no longer provide teaching staff to a facility, and those kids simply don't have access to teachers until the facility can negotiate a contract with another board. So no student's education should be held hostage to the will of a school board.
So the corrections department, I'm guessing, doesn't have its own fleet of teachers, if I can put it that way?
The teachers that go into these facilities come from school boards in the Ontario school system.
And are they full-time teachers already? Are they part-time or retired teachers? Like, who are we bringing in?
That varies somewhat. So they're full-time teachers. They're regular teachers, fully certified in Ontario. But again, it's up to the board to decide who to send in. So the facilities themselves don't have a lot of control. One of the unique features of some of this youth population is that a lot of them need individual learning plans. Some of them have had, you know, very serious trauma in their lives. There are a particular set of skills that a teacher would benefit from in working with these populations. And there's nothing that guarantees that teachers with those particular and special skill sets will be assigned to work in these facilities. So we do have a subsidiary recommendation about making sure that the right kind of teaching staff with the right training are the ones who are in contact with these youth.
And I would imagine the right number of teachers too, right? Because I would think this would be more staff intensive than just, lack of a better term, a regular classroom.
Absolutely, because of the special needs of many of these learners, because of the fact that many of them were behind in their education before they came into contact with the justice system. These are young people who need extra help often, and so you don't just need the right people, you need the right number of people to go in and give them a leg up.
And Brenda, is there a place we can point to and say, those people are doing it more right, or at the very least, they're doing it more right than we are?
So, I mean, we did find that there was a big variety across the facilities that we looked at. It's not the case that everywhere in Ontario is doing a terrible job. For reasons of research confidentiality, we don't talk about which facilities are which. But we do have examples of places where even in this province, some facilities are doing better than others. But that needs to be consistent. It's not fair for a young person that because of where they happen to live and where they were incarcerated, their chances of, you know, good education that can lead them towards rehabilitation are radically different. So what we need in these systems is government accountability to ensure that there's consistency, that all of these young people get an equal opportunity to get a decent education and reenter society with a chance at moving forward with, you know, employment and a better life.
What happens to this report now, Brenda? Where does it go? Who gets to see it?
So we conducted this research with the permission of the ministry responsible for youth prisons. We are going to be speaking with them in more detail about our findings, and they've indicated serious interest in what we found. So we're very hopeful that the report will be in the hands of the right people who, if the political will exists, really do have the capacity to make some very relatively straightforward changes that could really improve the system.
Political will is always difficult to find, but then also, you know, as we head into election period, sometimes it's too easy for parties to find someone that they can demonize to some degree, and I worry about that in this case.
I think how this issue, or if this issue gets picked up as part of a political election process, is beyond my pay grade. What we have tried to do with this report is bring the lived experience of the people who work with these young people and the young people themselves forward and provide a window of insight into a problem we have in Ontario that we can fix. Hopefully, politicians of all stripes who see it will, you know, be moved by that and understand that it's their responsibility to stand up for the most vulnerable young people in our province.
And ultimately, if we do this right, this is a money saver down the road, wouldn't it be?
Absolutely. It's a money saver and it's a life saver because, you know, it's expensive to keep somebody in a detention facility as opposed to giving them the skills that they need to go out and become a taxpayer, somebody who contributes to society. So a small investment up front could lead to really big payoffs, not just save money, but actually pay off in the future, both financially as well as in just the benefits to human lives.
Brenda, thanks for your time today.
Very grateful to have a chance to talk to you. Thank you.
Brenda McPhail from the Canadian Civil Liberties Association, their report, which lists 19 recommendations to some places, as she said, some detention centers for youth, are doing a pretty good job in terms of providing education and the help that these young people will need to perhaps move along. You're not going to get to everybody, We know that. But if you actually, if you look at this, the stats on it, in 2016, 67% of young men without a high school degree were employed. That's the lowest rate Canada has seen since 1994. Now, that is 5 years old. Probably hasn't changed dramatically, but 67% of young men without a high school degree were employed. That's where some of the problem begins. Now, a lot of these kids have had a difficult time going through school. That's not excusing their behavior. They're already being detained. Right? So let's get that out of your head right away. The question is, once you've got them detained, what are you going to do with them? You're going to just keep them in there? This is the couple of years you've got them until they turn a certain age and then move on into the adult system. That 16 to 18 year age window is really important in terms of having some level of reach. So they're already being punished. They're being detained, even if they are awaiting a trial. And how should we spend our day? Maybe we should spend our day helping them. And then when they get out, maybe they turn into better people. I think you got more of a chance doing it that way than just leaving them there. Star 570-570-2545, 1-800-570-5715. Maybe the problem with the whole thing is it makes too much sense and would save money down the road. And some parties don't want to be seen as, quote, soft on crime. This is Kitchener Today on City News 570.
We've got people who were convicted. We've got people who have yet to be convicted. And in general, it tends to be fairly serious charges because we do have a policy in Ontario of not wanting to incarcerate young people. So the people who are in there tend to be the ones who are the most marginalized, the most vulnerable, the ones who have had a really hard row to hoe over the course of their life and need some help.
Brenda McPhail of the Canadian Civil Liberties Association, their report into education for youth in Ontario's detention facilities, paints a picture of some very different circumstances depending on where you might be detained. Rob, go ahead.
Tough subject, buddy. But listen, some people, I mean, you help them. If they do a crime, you help them. They get off. They figure, well, hey, I got off. Maybe I'll get off again.
Yeah, I think that. I think, Rob, yeah, we're always going to have some people
of
like
course.
That.
But you know, it's like a homeless person. We want to help them, but some of them just like to be homeless.
Yeah, maybe they do. I don't know that. I just know that if we're putting people into detention centers, we should. If you're being held in a detention center when you're 16, I think you should get the same schooling as the kid on the outside gets.
Definitely the same schooling. And you know what? Maybe sit down with them and say, why? You know, is there something we can change to make you not do that again?
Well, yeah, and maybe that's, I think you want them to come out better
again,
than they go in.
You know, but kids are always going to be kids.
Oh, yeah.
They're going to experience. They're going to try new things. And sometimes it's not the right thing. They're kids. They make mistakes.
They may do something stupid. That's what I've learned.
Exactly. you know, depending on the severity of it, I mean, maybe we should just let them go.
All right. Thanks, Rob. Appreciate the call. I really do believe this, that when you have them in detention facilities like that, you should have an obligation to provide them with at least the same opportunity for education. Now, can you drag them kicking and screaming down the hall to go to class? Perhaps not. It maybe has to look different from what it does in other schools, but every opportunity has to be provided because I don't think there's any other way that you have those people come out better people than when they went in. And it's not a matter of being soft on them because they're already being detained. They may get another sentence down the road. But it is, look, by the time they're 20 or 24 or 25, not to say you give up on people, but it's an entirely different situation than when they're 16 or 17. And it's not all bad childhood. It's not all those other things. It's probably far more individual than it would be in the regular school system, even though individual learning plans are quite common. But I would say it would be likely to be more common. It's a good place to spend a few dollars because the outcome suggests you're going to save a few dollars. As Brenda rightfully points out, it's really expensive to put people in prison. You're feeding them three meals a day. You're giving them everything else they need. It is not the cheapest way to run things. Coming up on the other side, it is Giving Tuesday. And it gets a lot of attention over the last few years, especially where we have a Black Friday, where you can shop to your heart's content. We have a Cyber Monday, where you can go online and have your identity stolen. And then we have Giving Tuesday, where you can support your favorite charity. Tanya Little, the Director of Partnerships for Food Banks Canada, will join us just after 2 this afternoon. I think Giving Tuesday does provide a level of awareness, although like everything else, I believe awareness tends to level off after a few years. Like, how long did it take for you to become aware of Black Friday? Now you probably don't need the awareness anymore. Maybe somewhat similar in the Giving Tuesday realm, but we'll talk to Tanya about that just after 2 p.m. This is Kitchener Today on City News 570. Coming up after 2:30 this afternoon, Alice Kinsella, the marketing manager at Communitech, will join us, talk about all the things that are going on in the tech industry as we head into the holiday season. Today is a Tuesday, which is Giving Tuesday. Yesterday was Cyber Monday. I don't think Sunday was anything. Friday was Black Friday. But here we are. Tanya Little is the Director of Partnerships for Food Banks Canada, joins us this afternoon. Good afternoon, Tanya.
Why, hello there, Brian. Thanks for having me.
I was working for a nonprofit for a couple of years, just a few years back when Giving Tuesday really began to start in this country. Is it effective, Tanya, in the first thing, raising money?
I absolutely think it has built some real great traction within kind of the broad public sentiment. I know for a lot of people, this really kicks off their giving season. I mean, other than all the shopping they may have done on Black Friday, I think this is the beginning of the philanthropic season. And I think as more charitable organizations have learned to utilize it as a marketing tool to talk to people and kind of bring them in and engage them, it absolutely has increased the amount of giving that they're seeing, you know, earlier in December going into that season of giving.
Is it increasing the amount of giving totally? Do we know that? Or is it just shifting it a bit? Because that sometimes happens.
Yeah, I'll be honest, I can't speak to the total stats for Giving Tuesday across.
Sure.
What I will say is from Food Banks Canada's lens, initially, that was our greatest concern, actually, as we began Giving Tuesday only a couple of years ago as an organization. But what we ended up seeing was both absolutely some donors made the choice to give a little bit early. Some folks actually made another or second gift, like a special gift to mark Giving Tuesday, or they use that to basically make a gift to someone to honor them going into the holiday season. So we have absolutely seen a real increase in motivation and inspiration. And for us, we really see it as a central mechanism to celebrate philanthropy, share gratitude, and make people feel really good about connecting with and understanding our mission at whole.
So you are the Director of Partnerships for Food Banks Canada, so this might be even more in your wheelhouse. I wonder if this entire Giving Tuesday discussion campaign has had an impact at the corporate level where they can say, look, I'm more aware of this now, let's step in and help out at this time.
Absolutely. We have seen profound adoption by the corporate sector writ large. And I think more and more companies are looking for creative ways that they can really integrate cause and purpose into their philanthropic endeavors. In our case, last year, we were able to build a tremendous partnership with Skip the Dishes. And through that partnership, we were able to, you know, build a new partner and also really connect philanthropy in a new way. So this year, Skip the Dishes actually returned for a second year, and they are doing two things. So the first thing is, today, outside of like the traditional giving that normally happens, of which Skip will match some giving, the other thing is that when you make the decision to, for example, order in a meal for yourself or your family or friends today, Skip the Dishes will also donate a dollar from every order placed on the Skip network to Food Banks Canada. And we know $1 equals 2 meals with Food Banks Canada. So it's a great way to not only feed yourself, but also give back and help support your neighbors in need.
There is a lot of, I hate to say it, but it's true. There's a lot of competition out there in the charitable landscape. So I wonder if a Giving Tuesday promotion, does that lend itself more easily to the bigger players, or does it help even the field a little bit for the smaller ones?
I think as I'm seeing more and more charities, again, adopt, I think people are just becoming more creative with how they integrate Giving Tuesday and all of their giving strategies. So for some smaller organizations, it may be that they get, a local foundation or a philanthropic donor who might be willing to, double the gifts that are coming in to inspire that giving. In the cases of kind of medium-sized or larger ones, they could be doing things similar to us, which they've attached a cause marketing activation, or maybe they have a matching donor and a cause marketing activation to it. I think at the end of the day, we really want to inspire and motivate philanthropy. And I choose to not see it as competition. I think there's so many great causes out there that it's just a plethora of opportunity for people to really identify the causes that mean the most to them and then reach out and make a gift and hopefully get it doubled or tripled in the process.
Yeah, the important thing is for somebody to actually donate to something they believe in, right?
Absolutely. I always really encourage people to give till they're proud. And in the food bank world, that can mean their time. That can mean making a food donation, when you're at the grocery store. Or that can be being very intentional about making a financial contribution. And in the case of food banks, a financial contribution provides the greatest level of flexibility to local food banks so that they can buy culturally appropriate and relevant food that's specific to the people that come to their food bank. And more we know the importance of providing dignity to people when they come in the door. And part of that is ensuring that there's food that is really representative of their own communities, their own practices, and their own families. We all like to sit down and have a nice meal together with familiar food. So it's really important to not, only give those stereotypical items that people have always historically associated with giving to food banks.
Well, I know a year ago, Tanya, an awful lot of food banks were talking about how, it was going to be a very difficult year, and hopefully by this time next year it'll be better. Here we are this time next year. Is it better?
I wish I could say it was. The issue of food security is such a big issue and an ongoing issue. From our perspective, we released the Hunger Count report just a couple of weeks ago. And in fact, in the month of March of 2021 alone, the number of visits made to food banks across Canada was about 1.3 million visits. And just for perspective, that's a 20% increase compared to March 2019. So unfortunately, those numbers are increasing. And if you look at the largest urban centers, they've seen real influx, in some cases, 50% plus more clients coming through their doors. So this is a big issue. It's an ongoing issue, and it's something that we absolutely can address with substantive policy change. And so our focus is not only that relieving hunger today, but really looking to put in place the policy changes necessary to prevent hunger tomorrow.
See, I would really kind of like all of the food banks to be out of business. I just think in a country that has this resources, there is no reason for anyone to have to use one.
Amen, Brian.
So I really want you out of work. I do.
Yeah, well, I would also love to put myself out of work. And I will say, if the issues around food insecurity were easy to solve, they long would have been. That's why it's such a wicked issue. But I do think that there are, positive changes that we have seen. So, for example, if you look during the pandemic, we saw the federal government make some fairly substantive investments in social supports for Canadians. And we know that those social supports actually probably were the single greatest reason why we didn't have a spike of 100 or 200% increases in the number of people that came through our door. So we do know that sound social policy can make a substantive impact, because poverty is really about income security. So, we know that there are absolutely things that can be done, and that is absolutely part of our mission and our focus as Food Banks Canada, is to really get those policy changes in place. And we know that philanthropy is a huge agent making that happen.
Tanya, thanks very much for your time today.
Brian, thanks for having me, and happy Giving Tuesday.
Tanya Little is the Director of Partnerships for Food Banks Canada. She believes it has made a difference in some places. I think it does. And at the very least, perhaps awareness maybe make you think about it. And any day that you actually think about making a donation is a good day, because most days you probably don't. We do tend, unless we are involved in kind of a constant giving campaign, we do tend to kind of squirrel our way through things where we see a cause that all of a sudden is important to us, and then we'll give to that right at that moment. All the places like the planned giving, because that helps them plan a little bit better. I completely get that. I don't know how much actual impact Giving Tuesday has, but if it does nothing but raise awareness, then that is a good thing in some ways, especially for those smaller organizations. And if you go onto the Giving Tuesday at Waterloo Region website, you can see all of the various organizations that are involved in Giving Tuesday. Some of them might surprise you. They're a little bit outside of what you might consider a normal charitable realm, but they are still there, and you would have an opportunity to support them. Rush, go ahead.
Hey, Brian. Yeah, I'm with you. I feel like, you know, in a country like Canada where we have massive ability for food production, there is really no reason that we should have to have programs like this. But I don't know, like, it's easy for us to say that, and it's really challenging. So far, it's been proving impossible to actually solve the problem. I remember it wasn't that long ago, like within the last month or so, the World Health Organization or one of the UN type things came out and said something like, you know, if Elon Musk just donated his salary, we could solve world hunger. And Elon replied and said, tell me what you want to use the money for, to be open and transparent about it, and I'll give you that donation, no problem. And of course, like, you know, it gets nowhere. I think that, I'm not trying to paint your guest with this brush, but I think that that's part of the problem, is that these big sort of intergovernmental and NGO type projects get created more as, I'm sure they're created with good intention, but they end up morphing into being just another wasteful program that, you know, the bulk of the money is going to Band-Aid fixes and not actual solutions for the problem.
Well, and my argument for that, Rush, would be that the reason it goes to Band-Aid solutions is because you can't get everybody to work together for some reason. So you end up, okay, we will provide food because people are hungry, but we're not solving the problem of why the people are hungry in the first place. And that's a money problem, I think, more than it's a food problem in our country. Other countries, yeah, it may be a food problem.
Yeah, like that. I remember learning that at some point when I was much younger and wondering, like, why we had this problem, thinking, you know, with the naivety of a child, you sort of think, well, we just don't have enough food for all the people that's out there. But then you become a little bit more mature and you realize that,
we got lots
no,
of food.
We have plenty of food. We have more than enough food. It's really just a problem of distribution, right? I don't know how you solve it, but I just know that giving the government more money is a recipe not for a solution.
All right, thanks, Rush. Appreciate it. Dan, go ahead.
Hey, Brian. I just had to say that somebody I always give to, and I've had to receive some when I got in trouble when I was very young, was the Salvation Army. They just gave us food, made sure we were well, and then sent us on our way. They were just a fabulous organization. I encourage everybody to give to them.
All right. Thanks, Dan. Appreciate that. It's not necessary for everybody to name their favorite charity at this point, but it's always good to have a little bit of a testimonial in the bag. Dan, I'm glad that worked out for you. And certainly, you know, I will say this. From my experience working inside the sector, I'm not going to tell you that there wasn't wastage. Of course there is. There's wastage everywhere. Whether it's government, whether it's private business, whether it's in the charitable sector, there is some wastage. Rush was right on one thing. These programs are created with the very best of intentions, but that best of intention may not necessarily be the solution that we need. But there's no problem in producing food. We got lots. Sometimes it's a problem in getting it to the right people. Sometimes it's a problem in people being able to afford it. But as far as having enough food to feed people, we got tons. Tom, go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
The dairy farmers associations, they throw out a lot of milk. The grains that we had here for wheat, they probably could feed the whole world. So you're right, we do have a lot of, but it's how we get there or why we're not giving it away. To keep the prices really high.
Well, and sometimes, Tom, you can give it away, you still can't get it to where it needs to go.
Yeah, I know. Like, I look at W5, I think they did the whole thing on the Wii charity, and millions were wasted, and nobody knows where they've gone. So
yeah, thanks, Tom. And you know, the funny thing is, the story like that kind of impacts a whole lot of other places that do really good work.
The other thing with the Cancer Association, well, maybe 10% they get to the real thing.
No, Tom, Tom, that's not true, okay? It's not 10%.
Well, a lot of it goes to subsidize all these charities, the events that they make to get the money.
Well, yes, there's an administration cost to those things, Tom, but in this day and age, in this day and age, Tom, there's a lot of competition for charitable dollars. So if you're an organization that's trying to raise money without that kind of specific skill set,
on
good
a
luck.
High level, on a big level,
good luck.
It's hard.
Going to be tough to do. All right, thanks, Tom. Appreciate the call. Yeah, and we hear that all the time. Heard it when I worked inside the nonprofits as well, that, you know, administration, there shouldn't be. Remember, so many of those organizations started off with a group of volunteers. And as you move along down the road, look, fundraising is tough money. It's a tough job. And you do need a level of expertise at those areas. And that costs money. I know we all want to think everybody's giving because it's the right cause. That's not the way it always works. Now, obviously, you want to know what the impact of that dollar amount is, too. And that can be just as important, if not more important, than administration costs. It's not the only thing to consider. But I do realize it's always a question of discussion when it comes to charities. This is Kitchener Today on City News 570. If you don't already support a charity throughout the year, well, now's a good time to maybe pick one. Help out so many good causes. If you're not sure, like maybe you've just heard of the big ones and you want to dig a little deeper into it, just Google Giving Tuesday Waterloo Region. You'll be able to find a page which you can then scroll through and see the dozens, if not hundreds, of organizations that are looking for your support. And I'm sure you're going to find something that fits into your wheelhouse. I'm just reading this, and it was the headline that caught my attention, which, by the way, is a good reason to write a headline to catch your attention. American scientists who created the first living robots say the life forms can now reproduce. I know, robots that can reproduce. They're known as xenobots, and they can reproduce in a way not seen in plants or animals. So, not sure about the plants one, but the animal kind looks fun. Formed from the stem cells of the African clawed frog, one of the greatest predators in Africa, from which it takes its name. Xenobots are less than a millimeter wide. The tiny blobs were first unveiled in 2020 after experiments showed they could move, work together in groups, and self-heal. Now the scientists that developed them at, strangely enough, the University of Vermont, as well as Harvard. I'm not sure they studied anything at the University of Vermont, but apparently they do. The Institute for Biologically Inspired Engineering. Well, that sounds terrifying. They have say they have discovered an entirely new form of biological reproduction, different from any animal or plant known to science. So apparently frogs have a, not apparently, this is true, frogs have a way of reproducing that they normally use, but when you liberate the cells, you give them a chance to figure out how to be in a new environment. Not only do they figure out a new way to move, they also figure out, apparently, a new way to reproduce. That's that you know, desire to survive, that desire to propagate and to leave your legacy. Well, haven't we all felt that at some point or another? But these are essentially robot blobs. And they can reproduce, and they can work together. Haven't we seen that movie? It was The Blob. And they all worked together, and then they eventually took over a really crappy-looking town. I think it was Steve McQueen who fought the Blob. 1955? Guessing on that. This is irresponsible. University of Vermont, Tufts University, and even Harvard. The supercomputer that helped them through reproduction, and we all need one of those, came up with a C-shape that resembles Pac-Man, the 1980s video game. That's where I'm guessing these scientists got their inspiration. Hey, Steve, Can we make it look like Pac-Man? Yeah, that'll be cool. That'll scare the hell out of everybody. Eventually, that's the way we die. We'll be eaten up by blobs that came from a frog. They don't have any practical applications yet. Good news there. But ultimately, they're hoping that they'll be able to do something perhaps as useful as collecting those microplastics in the ocean. Well, that's a good idea. Feed them up on plastic. Then we'll never be able to get rid of them. Nobody is thinking this through. Maybe I'll have to ask Alex Kinsella, marketing manager for Communitech. They would know. They're in the tech industry. They know everything. We'll be back with Alex on the other side. This is Kitchener Today on City News 570.
Walk that walk. Talk that talk. Walk that walk. Talk that talk. Walk that walk. Talk that talk.
Just trying it out for the first time, our Kickstart solar-powered spotlight. We had our engineers install it today, so it should work. Walk that walk. Oh, if that doesn't work, we'll get the guy who fixed the door in, because he seemed to know what he was doing. We liked him a lot. Every Tuesday at 2:30, we shine our tech spotlight on something happening in the community. Usually it's on, you know, one organization or one company. But this time, we've got a way wider spotlight. We're going to have to increase the spectrum of our light. Alex Kinsella joins us this afternoon. Good afternoon, Alex.
Hey, how are you doing today?
I'm all right. How are you?
Not bad at all.
Looking forward, you've got a big market coming up on Friday, December 10th, which is like the first time you've seen actual people in 2 years, right?
It does. I mean, we make all these jokes about, you know, something happens and nature is healing. And I feel like these in-person markets where we get to shop local from awesome local vendors is a sign of that.
And so the one that's coming up December 10th is the Holiday Hub Market. So how does this work, Alex?
So it's like most of the markets you go to. A couple of years ago, we decided, you know, we would look at our reception desk and we'd see boxes from Amazon and a whole bunch of other online places coming through. We're like, you know, we need a way to help our kind of our local startups shop local and discover, you know, awesome, again, awesome local vendors and makers and everything you can think of. So we decided we've got this space. Why don't we put together a market? So we put out a call to some vendors and some people showed up and we did it every year after that until the pandemic, of course. So this year we're actually going to be in the space that used to be known as a Tannery Event Center right there in the first floor of the Tannery right by the parking lot. And we've got over 20 vendors coming through. It's a real life local market. So can't wait to see people in person.
So what kind of vendors are included in that, Alex? Are there any people like probably selling robots, because I know it's the tech community here.
Yeah, you know, we've had a couple robot-like things in the past, which is always a little interesting. I get a little still weirded out by robots, and I know that's weird because I work in tech, but robots are robots, and I've seen too much science fiction. But we've got everything from like great local graphic designers selling prints and T-shirts. We've got someone that does urban gardening, so they have seeds and plantlings and things that you can do to get ready for next year's planting season. We've got a couple different vintage and refurbished clothing makers. We've got In Her Shoes, which is a great local organization that helps women start their own businesses, which is, again, a really good way to give people, you know, an opportunity to kind of create something for themselves and grow. So, and they're back for their third year, I think.
Well, and the interesting thing about a lot of these markets, Alex, is I've noticed the ones the last couple of years that are coming back, they seem to be just a little bit different, you know, in terms of what they offer or in terms of what the story of those vendors was. Either they survived 2 years of a pandemic or they've started something brand new. Either way, it's an interesting story.
Yeah, and even in ours, we have a couple people who are in the tech community who have, you know, the side hustle, and they've launched something new, whether it's on Etsy or Shopify, and they go to a bunch of markets. So it's cool to see, you know, people who have this passion or hobby and turning it into a business that could become the next, you know, the next big thing.
You know, and that's every now and then I try to look for something positive out of 2 years of a pandemic. And believe it or not, they are out there. And one of the things I kind of think is a positive is the number of people who, you mentioned, side hustles, able to get online, able to turn it into something. Like, I think we're going to see some growth there in the next couple of years that maybe we didn't expect.
Yeah, it's one of those things, especially within tech. One of the things that really helps like traditional tech startups is it's really easy to get a website up and, you know, integrate billing and customer service and all these tools. The tech side of it, it's much more simple now. And the same now goes for people who are launching clothing lines or makeup lines or Bath and Body Works or whatever. Like a Shopify store is so easy to get set up, or an Etsy store is really easy to get set up. And then you have all these, you know, great ways of whether it's newsletters and social media, building up an audience for your product and your business and launching something great.
See, and I come from a time, and you might remember this too, where everybody put up a website because everybody was putting up a website. They had no idea what the hell they were going to do with it, but they put a website up. And one of the things the pandemic really did, I think, was take some people and say, yeah, we've had a website. Let's go make it do something.
Yeah, and that's the big thing. And now it's really like the website is still an anchor. And if you have a Shopify store, that's your website today. But using, you know, the positive of social media really is helping people discover your product or your company, your service, whatever it happens to be, and driving them and you know, hopefully, again, getting new customers.
Well, and we do occasionally have to have a positive in social media, too. It's good that we can find one.
I think that's the big one right now is really that. And you know, especially this year with either people have their side hustles or just smaller businesses, shopping local. And whether that's at, you know, your favorite brick and mortar stores like J&J Collectibles or Gifted, or online from local makers, or at markets like this one coming up on December 10th, is a great way to, you know, kind of, you know, kickstart the economy, right? We want to spend money here locally and support our neighbors.
So, Alex, every week we have somebody on from the tech community here in Waterloo Region. Now, they may not still be here, but they have a connection. It all started here, whatever. But, you know, 2 years into this pandemic, does the tech industry look the same to you in the region as it did 2 years ago?
I think I've been able to get out more and more now, which is always kind of fun, and see people in real life. And a lot of it is the same, but people have changed companies. There's a lot of people who are working remote, which is a big trend that's come out of the pandemic. So there'll be people in town who work for Facebook and who work for other companies that don't have offices here. So what's really important is finding ways to connect them with cultural and artistic and charitable organizations in town and really kind of help them form a bond to the community. I think that's going to be the biggest change coming out of this, is people don't have those same ties anymore. 2 years is a long time. So how do we do that?
Yeah, and you know, you mentioned 2 years, a long time. Well, Shopify had its offices in Uptown Waterloo, and now that one building on Willis Way has transitioned over to Fair. But again, it's another company with some local roots. And, you know, the physical changes are there, too.
Yeah, that's the big thing, right? Seeing the names on the buildings change and where people have their offices. I know I've made a couple of mistakes where I try to show up to a meeting and I'm like, no, we moved to, you know, the other side of town now. So, I think we need like a map or something to help us find where people are. But again, it's exciting to see, you know, as companies adopt, whether it's the hybrid work model with people in the office, you know, part of the time. But just, again, seeing people out and about. One of the big reasons we were excited for the market is, you know, we want a lot of, you know, the community, and this market's open to the community as well. But we want people to kind of come downtown and not just come to our market, but go get a coffee at Matter of Taste if you're downtown, or check out Unzipped at the museum, or shop at any of the local stores that are in downtown Kitchener.
Yeah, it's time to get out and see some people and some things again, right?
Yeah, that's just it. I was out yesterday downtown, and I ran into four people I knew that I hadn't seen, two of them in 2 years, and it's absolutely fantastic to get out and about again.
You crazy rebel, you.
I know. It was just 2 hours. It was 2 hours, and I had to come back. So.
This market takes place Friday, December 10th, right?
Yes, that's right. And we'll be open from 11 to 4. I'm probably sure I probably got that time wrong. But we'll be there. And, it's open to the public. Come down, check it out, and shop local.
I'm assuming the usual protocols apply?
Yeah, proof of vaccine to come in, and the vendors are all vaccinated. And, it's a good vaccinated shop local time.
And you may have a limit on the number of people you can have in there. I don't know.
Yeah, and physical distancing and masks.
Okay, all the usual stuff that we've all gotten, sadly, way too used to.
I remember my mask more than my keys now.
I have several copies of both, to be honest.
Yeah.
Alex, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
All right, Alex Kinsella is in marketing at Communitech. Their holiday hub market goes Friday, December 10th from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the former Tannery Event Center. You know where that is, right? They have about 20 vendors or so, all very different. And happy to have you come through. If you're looking for something a little bit different and something a little bit local, I'm going to be big on that over the next little while. So when we get a chance to talk to people here in town, and we are lining those up as we speak, we'll be focusing more on the local as opposed to, you know, the big stuff from somewhere else. Because it's going to be important once we, well, if we get through this, not to be too pessimistic. Kyle, go ahead.
Be positive, my friend. Be positive. You know?
I am positive.
I got a question for you.
Okay.
Okay, before the, what were you talking about? Robots reproducing.
You're kind of, I'm getting a little funky sound from your phone there, Kyle.
Sorry, can you hear? Is this better? Is this better? Is this better?
That's much better.
Okay, sorry. I said, before the Tech Tuesday spotlight, did you say that robots are going to be reproducing?
No, they are reproducing as we speak. They're called.
And people are not worried about this?
I'm tremendously worried about it. They're called Xenobots. And they have found a new way to reproduce.
Okay, that's the last thing I need is some Xenobot coming to my house, taking over my house, reproducing, and then next thing you know, I'm living in my car.
I think we're early on that, Kyle. I think it's something that we should keep in the back of our minds.
No, it's going to be in the front of my mind now. You know, everything, the pandemic, nope, that's it. Robots taking over the world, that's it. They're Brian, I'm done. I'm moving.
There's an upside. Look, they have independently learned how to reproduce. It's a learning opportunity.
And yet, I'm still single, so what's wrong with that picture, right?
You have not independently learned how to reproduce, Kyle. So that's that simple.
All right, thanks, Brian.
You're welcome. I should get in more trouble. I don't know why I don't. Back to wrap up and look ahead. This is Kitchener Today on City News 570. I'll take you back briefly to the Xenobots, so you can be concerned about this if you want. But now, in this particular report, these are a couple of sentences that you have probably heard in a science fiction movie, and they turned out to be lies. I'm just telling you that. While the prospect of self-replicating biotechnology could spark concern, the researchers say the living machines were entirely contained in a lab and easily extinguished, as they are biodegradable and regulated by ethics experts. So there's no possible way they could ever escape from a lab, right? And the ethics experts, they couldn't be bought off, could they? Ha, you haven't seen the same documentaries that I've seen. And then this. The research was partially funded by the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. That's DARPA. The Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. There are many things that are possible, he says, if we take advantage of this kind of plasticity and ability of cells to solve problems. I warned you. It's that simple. Now you know. And so 5 years down the road, when a blob of something comes and eats Kyle, we'll know what the reason was. So, Kyle, I may have made fun of you. I think you should be deeply, deeply, deeply concerned that something is coming to take over your life. Never trust them when they say it's been entirely contained in a lab. And I know, and I mean that too, never trust them. That has been published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, PNAS. Pronounce that however way you wish. And I'm not making that part up. So, that's where we are in terms of robots et al. Coming up a little bit later this week, well, there's a couple of different things that I'm trying to get answers to in terms of the bigger picture. Now, some of it relates to the housing encampment here in the region and how that went sideways in a hurry. That again, that fits in with my food bank question. That I just don't believe in a country like this that we should have to have people living in tents. Now, I realize some people will not go inside a shelter. Some people cannot. Some people have had difficulties with that in the past. So I recognize all that. But it just shouldn't be that way. And we've talked about it for a long, long, long time. And I don't even know what the solution is. And I'm not sure anybody does know what the solution is. There are connections there to all kinds of different things. Education, obviously. Mental health is another one. There's a variety of different things that all play into those factors. Income insecurity is again, that's another one right there. That may tie to education. But we live in this country where there are tons of opportunities. We really do. Right? We've seen all the stories about people who are looking for people to work. So we know that there are plenty of opportunities out there, but we also know that some people don't get an opportunity to take part in those particular opportunities. So the food bank and the homelessness one are two things that I don't understand why we have those in this country, because we should be able to solve it. And if we got every level of government and every nonprofit organization and every citizens group working together, we could probably come up with as close to a solution as we could get. Maybe we wouldn't be perfect, but we'd be closer than we are today. Because what we're doing these years seems to be simply rinsing and repeating and not getting anywhere further down the line. It's the same way I feel about food banks. I felt over the past of the last 30, 40 years that we should have gotten the point where at some level there'd be less of a demand, right? Wouldn't that be the goal? Makes sense to me, but perhaps I'm just missing something on that one. We have now, and this is a record for us, we have now had the Christmas tree up on our house for 2 weeks, and it has yet to be decorated. The tree's up. It's got lights on it. It's got absolutely nothing else on it except an angel.
I'm in the exact same situation.
Do you have an angel on top of
yours? No, we don't even have the angel yet. Well, you're going to love this. We don't put an angel or a star.
What do you
have? We actually found, a couple of years ago, a squirrel tree topper.
Nice.
So we put a squirrel on top of our tree.
You put whatever you want up there.
There you go. Oh, okay. I thought you'd be rolling your eyes.
No, that's the other one. He's the whole traditionalist person, not me. If you want to put a squirrel up there.
I think we found it at Canadian Tire.
That's where you get your quality tree toppers. There's no question. I didn't know there was a squirrel available. I don't know what else I would put on top of that. Generally, we've had an angel. Once in a while, we've had a star when the angel has stopped working because the angel has lights in it. And we didn't feel like going out to get one until after Christmas so we could buy it cheaper. Then we just put the metal star. But now, oddly enough, this week, we discovered we have two angels and we don't know why. Neither one of us remembers buying a second one, but we have two and they both work. Now, the one has a little rotating device inside that creates a...
Sounds like Unsolved Mysteries. Do you know where the second angel came from?
Good in time. We have a number of different mysteries in what we lovingly refer to as the Christmas box. It's more than one box, and it's very, very, very large. There is a lot of Christmas crap in my life, from beads... Now, we have none of those popcorn strings because my kids did those 1 year, and my wife just felt it created such a mess that she never even gave them the opportunity to make another string of popcorn. Plus, after a while, unless you cover them in lacquer, which is an awful lot of work, they eventually start to decompose a little bit. So they're not that much fun. We do have a handful of wooden ornaments that were painted by children years and years and years ago. We keep those. A couple of paper ones made the same way. I think we have one baby's first Christmas, and then after that we lost interest. So we would tell them at the time, no, here's your baby's first Christmas. And then they all learned how to read, so that ruined that fun for us. So we only have one baby's first Christmas. I think we have one grandchild's first Christmas. So just in case you thought we were unfairly treating different generations, no. I don't know does anybody get a baby's fourth Christmas? I don't think that happens, does it? I had baby's 17th Christmas. That would be a pretty funny novelty item, actually. Just slip a picture in every year. Baby's 64th Christmas. I wish I thought of that a few years ago. That would have been a ridiculously good idea. I think the plan, I was told last night the plan might be to decorate the tree. That went out the window. So the plan might be to decorate the tree tonight, but it will not be to decorate the tree on Thursday because I'm going to the theater. First time in over 2 years that we'll go to the theater. Here's the funny part about it. So my wife is an incredibly large and disturbingly exuberant fan of some old country music. Now, that's because she was raised on that stuff. The old George Jones, Tammy Wynette, you know what, you're leaving me because you love your dog better, that kind of song. She was raised on all that stuff.
There's a tear in my beer because I'm crying for you, dear.
That's right. You know, and so she likes a lot of the new stuff too, but she really likes that stuff. So an opportunity came along for us to attend the Patsy Cline show at Drayton Entertainment, and they always do a great job on their shows. So I thought, I know she'd like this. I don't know if I will or not. No disrespect to anybody. It's just that's not necessarily my genre. As you would probably guess, my genre more in the hip-hop area. But, you know, Patsy Cline, not so much. But because this is one of the sacrifices you make when you're married, because she will like it, I've arranged to get a couple of tickets to the show. So we will go to the show on Thursday night. And that's opening night, because that's when all the VIPs go, kids. The hoi polloi, if you will, of the region. We will go, and I will tell you on Friday my review of it. And my review will be, you know what? Might not be my thing, but the performances are spectacular, and you should probably go if you're looking to get out. And let's get out, because I'm a great believer in the fact that there are very few things that are better than live theater. I just love live theater. I've only had a couple of really bad live theater experiences. And in one case, that was the fact that I made the mistake on selecting which show to go to, not recognizing that the person I lived with had no interest in that show. And the other one was just a really bad production of a show, which is a rarity because it was in Toronto and it was one of the Mervis shows. And if I remember right, it was Lord of the Rings. And trying to take the Tolkien masterpiece down to a 2.5-3 hour musical just did not work. Great special effects, but I'm telling you, it's the kind of show that had people on their feet and heading for the exits. That's what it was. Now, the other one was at Stratford, and the reason that was a mistake was because I was going through the Stratford Festival program, and I saw they were doing the musical Tommy, and I've actually always been a fan of the musical Tommy. Although, admittedly, when Tommy first came out, I may have been under the influence of something, so maybe that was why I was a fan of it. It was my teenage years. And I said, I'll get tickets for this, and my wife and I will go see Tommy, not recognizing that she hates Tommy. Absolutely the worst experience, and I'll tell you why. The show was great, the musicians were fabulous, the performances were incredible, but the person I went with kept elbowing me and telling me how much she didn't want to be there. That made for a very bad theater experience. So in this case, I am not going to do that. I am going to be on the high road on Thursday, constantly reminding someone that the reason you're here is because I gave a little bit from in here. That's why. Again, we've been married 42 years, 27 of them happy. Take that advice and absolutely, without a doubt, run with it. Brittany, I have to ask you a question. Do we have Rangers tickets tomorrow? We often have them on Wednesdays. We don't. What's wrong with this place? Hell. Wow. At all this week? No? Yes? No? Maybe? We don't know?
As of now, no. But, you know, people around here, sometimes they'll send the email about 2 minutes before to give the tickets away.
Yeah, and especially on this station where they barely recognize that we work here. Hopefully we will have tickets, and hopefully I'll be able to come up with a contest. That's all I can do. We'll see you tomorrow. Back here noon to 3. This is Kitchener Today on Sydney News 570.